Safety, dependability, and power. Chevy Silverado isn't happy unless the work is hard and the day is long. No wonder Silverado is America's number one best-selling retail pickup truck. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Leonard Mlodinow. Leonard is a theoretical physicist and author of five best-selling books. He co-wrote The Grand Design with Stephen Hawking, which reached number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Other books include Subliminal, The Drunkard's Walk, and War of the World Views, which he co-wrote with Deepak Chopra. Leonard has also written for such television shows as Night Court and Star Trek The Next Generation. His new book is called Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change. Leonard Mlodinow, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly. Great to be here.
Given that this particular podcast often focuses on the ways in which we operate in an unscripted manner, it seems appropriate for this conversation to start with the ways we operate in a scripted manner. And you write in your book, quote, scripted behavior is one of nature's shortcuts, a reliable coping mechanism that leads to results that are usually successful. Since most of us non-actors aren't handed sheets of paper with dialogue on it, how are humans in their everyday lives scripted?
Well, just as other animals are, we evolved in a manner by which we sometimes encounter circumstances that are very routine, and nature has seen fit to give us these skills of replying or acting without thinking in order to handle those situations in the easiest manner. One example is you're driving to work, you develop something called autopilot. So you get to a stop sign, you turn a certain way, you get to the light, you turn a certain way, and you may be thinking about something completely different when you do that. I used to have a problem. I worked at Caltech, mm-hmm. and I went there every day, and that's a few miles from my home in Pasadena. And sometimes I'd be going somewhere else that started the same route as Caltech, mm-hmm. and I would start thinking about something, and I would be on that route, and I would be on autopilot and not even notice. Obviously, my eyes are getting the data that I'm going toward Caltech, but my mind isn't processing it. And I'm on autopilot, turning when certain triggers in the environment, a certain stop sign or a stoplight or a street corner, they trigger me to turn, and I would just unconsciously follow and turn. And we have autopilot when we're driving, but we also have autopilot in our social interactions. And so that's one and the most crude or primitive manner of operating. But our thought, the human thought, is really on a spectrum. And mm-hmm. a little further toward the intelligence scale is what I call logical analytical thinking. And that is thinking by which you have certain assumptions or premises, and then you apply the rules of reasoning, and you get from one thing to another. But further over, which I claim is the most sophisticated kind of thinking, is this realm of thought called elastic thinking. And elastic thinking does not involve scripts. It does not involve following rules. It's where you make up the rules. It's the kind of thinking you use to invent rules, to realize that you should break rules, or to rework your point of view on a problem or an issue, or create the framework by which you're going to approach something that you've never seen before. And that's really the thinking that more and more we need in today's society.
Yeah, and, you know, you're backed up by the World Economic Forum, who released their, you know, Skills of the Future, which is problem-solving, creativity, divergent thinking. It's essentially what you're talking about is, you know, the jobs, in many ways, that the robots can't do are going to be these ones that require elastic thinking.
Exactly. In fact, that's a good topic. Hmm. Computers traditionally are what we call linear processors. They follow an algorithm that's fixed and written down beforehand, and they go from A to B to C, depending on the instruction when they get to that point in the algorithm. And they've done some very impressive things in competition with humans. Computers have beat us at chess, for instance, and beat the best humans at Jeopardy, all following this kind of logical, linear logical thinking. But computer scientists just in the last few years have realized the limits of that, and they start programming computers to be elastic thinkers. That means that they are now trying to compete with us on these realms where we can be problem solvers and creative and create new paradigms and new ways of looking at things and art. And the way they do that is by literally mimicking our brains by taking what they call artificial neural nets, which are electronic components that are supposed to mimic neurons, and connecting them in highly parallel ways, and finding ways for those neural networks to learn. So they're now programming computers, not by programming them in the traditional sense, which is by making up the rules that they should follow, but by putting together these neural networks and putting them in a situation where they can learn and figure out for themselves. And by doing this, they've applied it to different realms with tremendous, impressive success. One is they've beat the best human player in Go. Go is much more complicated than chess just because the board is so big and has so many possible moves. They've also, based on that, realized they should use it in more practical applications, and Google has applied it to Google Translate. You may have noticed that if you ever use Google Translate, one day, I forget when it was, a year or two ago, you're using Google Translate and it's pretty crappy. Mm-hmm. Next day you wake up and you go, my God, it's gotten better overnight. That's because they changed the way they approach it, and they threw out the old system and they put in a neural net system. So this is the wave of the future, and for many decades to come, I have no doubt that we can still outthink computers in this neural net bottom-up kind of elastic way. But eventually, now that the programmers are working on that, they will probably surpass us. But the advantage we have is that we have about 100 billion neurons in our brain, which are each connected to 1 or 10,000 other neurons. And the neural networks that they're constructing have dozens, maybe 100, and they're not just connected to a handful. So that we haven't found a way yet to build such large and highly connected neural networks. So that's the limits. That's why the neural network computers are very impressive, but they're really very narrowly focused because they're very limited systems compared to the human brain.
There's so much. I mean, one of the things I love about the book is there's really a lot of sort of surprising insights. One I got teed off to when we interviewed Ori Brofman, who's at Berkeley, who writes a lot about decentralized networks. And a lot of his stories in his last book talked about how money can kind of ruin these decentralized. It's like a virus against decentralized communities. And you talk about this in the sense of arts and science. And you write, quote, that the exercise of elastic thinking skills, such as idea generation, pattern recognition, divergent thinking, and imagination is inherently rewarding. And that's the reason that people have put energy into the arts despite the lack of material reward for most. So it's kind of interesting that money could get in the way of this elastic thinking.
It is fascinating. And studies and also historical anecdotes have shown that sometimes, or quite often, paying someone for their artistic output is counterproductive. Psychologists talk about two types of human motivation, extrinsic and intrinsic. And intrinsic is what comes from inside you. It's the things that you want to do, that you're motivated internally to do. And extrinsic are things that you're paid or rewarded to do from a society or a boss or a company. And intrinsic motivation is far more powerful, and the problem is that when you start mixing intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, the extrinsic motivation can dominate, and in the end, that causes that impedes elastic thinking, and it causes people to be focused more on the ends and on more straightforward means of achieving them, and they can even cause a mental block to being creative if you're working too much with the financial reward in mind.
Yeah. I didn't mention this in your bio, but you're a Chicagoan, correct?
I sure am, and I was at the Cubbies World Series game.
Oh, man. I think they're going to win today. Thank God they scored some runs just while we're waiting to come on the air. So I was talking to Christy Hefner. This was like in week four of the podcast, and she and I had been at the salon together, and it was a bunch of different people from varying sort of arts groups and media people and magazine people, thought leaders, talking specifically about what is it about Chicago that we've had so much sort of innovation come out of. And in that conversation, Christy and I sort of stumbled upon this idea that if you look at Second City and improvisation, if you look at house music, if you look at the spoken word poetry slam stuff that came out of Chicago, none of that stuff is ownable. The blues, it's not ownable. It is not tied to money in its sort of way that it operates in the city. People then go to the coasts and sort of profit from their innovation and their work. But when it's here, especially in the early origins of the stuff, there was no money changing hands.
Well, that's a nice thing about Chicago. It's a kind of New York creative, fun, adventurous atmosphere, but it's cheaper.
Yes.
So you can be in Chicago and you can experiment and you have less pressure on you than when you're in New York and you're going to get kicked out of your apartment or you got to invite, you know, the ninth and tenth roommates in because you can't afford the rent anymore. And so that's really nice. You can be more relaxed. And, you know, one of the main factors in elastic thinking, or one of the important factors, is avoiding the fear of failure.
Mm-hmm.
And related to that is avoiding the dislike of being wrong.
Yes.
When you have financial pressure, that often translates into I have to be right and I have to succeed, or else you're on the street or some other horrible thing happens to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, as an author and also as a physicist, I know that's poison, that feeling. When I'm a physicist looking at a problem, when I'm afraid of failing or being wrong, what do? I take the most straightforward, conventional approach.
Mm-hmm.
And that often doesn't work. What's needed is something different, a new way of looking at things. Otherwise, the problem would have been solved already, or else it's a trivial, stupid problem that no one cares about.
Right.
So, you know, when I'm looking at the problem and I feel rushed, or when I'm writing a chapter, and I know that I have to quit at a certain time, I don't have all day, then I'm when I start to think, what should I write? I don't open my mind. I don't go to strange places that might not work. I don't tell an anecdote that maybe is going to be stupid or embarrassing, and I'll just have to cut it later. But let me try it out and see how it sounds. You know,
yeah.
That's what I want to be able to do. I want to have the freedom to do that, and then I can edit it out later. That's so hard on me that a deadline that if I know I have to be somewhere like at 2. For an interview, let's say, and I'm working at 10, I just can't work. I mean, it ruins the whole day because I go, well, you know, in 4 hours I got to be somewhere. So when I'm writing, if this path doesn't work, I won't have time to finish it, throw it out, start again, and take a different approach. And so I just sit down and I end up writing crappy stuff. So I just give up. Don't work that day.
Yeah. But this is another thing.
I don't ever recommend that. It's just the way my mind works.
I know. But this is something that academia and improv artists share, right? So the idea in academia where you are, things are problematic. You're constantly trying to find the problem. And you're failing all the time because the only way you discover anything is when you fail. And all of the early improv exercises that we teach are about getting out of your shame and your fear brain. It is like exclusively that. It's kind of, I often call it noisy mindfulness, because we're having people really sort of focus in the present. We often set up exercises where they are going to fail fast just to get it kind of them used to it, because we are so wired, apparently, and you can tell us why, to avoid those failures, that we just don't do good work. And you know, I've auditioned, I worked at Second City for 30 years, auditions just probably millions of people, and you can tell the ones who aren't going to do well when they're walking up on the stage, because they are just in their fear brain and they're exuding it.
That's exactly what happens. We all, when it comes to idea generation, scientists have studied that in detail and detailed the processes in a very elaborate way that lead us to get ideas. And what's happening is that there are certain unconscious parts of your brain that you're not aware of that are constantly associating different concepts and ideas. Whenever you see something, hear something, think something, they're making associations.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in the old days, they would have psychologists or psychoanalysts would give you these word association tests, right?
Right.
What, they say a word, you say a word. But your brains are constantly doing that. Your brains are idea machines. Most of these ideas do not reach your conscious mind. If they did, you would drown in this storm of ideas. And most of the ideas are kind of random, silly, stupid, unconventional, and unworkable. When people are mentally ill, one of the problems can be that some of these crazy ideas come to them. Kids who often have these crazy ideas, I'll tell you why in a minute, but as a normal adult, most of the ideas are filtered out by these structures in your brain that scientists call cognitive filters. The cognitive filters let only through the most promising ideas, which is what you'd expect evolutionarily. Mm-hmm. They have promise, right? But a drawback of that is that some of the ideas that get filtered out that don't come through are these different ideas, which can sometimes be the really good ones. So
right.
The idea filters can keep you from solving a problem. They can create a mental block for you because your brain's theory of what's promising might not allow in the any idea that leads to the solution. And in science and in writing and in problem solving, we have the same issue that you have in improv, which is that you have to get rid of the fear brain. You have to relax those idea filters.
Mm-hmm.
And when the idea filters are relaxed, things will come through. They may be, if you're on stage when they come through, they may be embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
They may be bad jokes or whatever, bad associations. But if you don't let them through, you won't get the good ones. I worked with Robin Williams for a while on a computer game.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that personally, interacting with this person, he was constantly spewing humorous or humor potential comments, quips, and half of them were really funny, half of them weren't. Some of them were very inappropriate, but he knew how to relax that and create great stuff, and that's what we all have to do if we want to be creative.
I want to shift to, I found you talking about ants and the way that ants think as a group. The title of this is, you talk about the bottom-up brilliance of ants. So what can ant behavior tell us about inventive group processing?
Okay, so we talked earlier about scripted thinking, and this is all the thinking that the poor ants have. They have a set of algorithms. They have a very simple sensory system. Ants have a very simple sensory system, and they have a very simple set of rules which they apply. When a trigger from their sensory system gets triggered, they do X or Y. So think of them as very simple, rudimentary computers that have a small program.
Hmm.
And they move along, and each ant, I would feel free to say, without being too un-PC, is dumb. I think I can call ants dumb.
Dumb. We're not covering that yet.
Okay. They move along, and they may have simple reactions to simple events in their environment. And yet, if you look at the ant colony, it can do amazing things. In fact, for example, I don't know if you've ever seen photos of ants on a leaf, and they're moving, they want to get to a nearby leaf, and there's space between them, and they form an ant or a human bridge made of ants,
mm-hmm.
an ant bridge. They form an ant bridge from one leaf to the next. Now, we call that bottom-up because there is no architect, there's no designer, there's no CEO, there's no general, there's no boss. The queen ant is not telling them what to do. No one is planning this. It just happens. And how does it happen? It happens because through the miracle of evolution over millions and millions of years, the little ant, tiny little ant dumb programs have evolved in a way that collectively, when they're all put together and they reach certain stimulus in the environment, each ant reacts to that stimulus in a certain way, which causes the next ant to react to that reaction or that stimulus in a certain way, and the cascade of reactions, which, when you build it all up, causes this bridge to be formed.
Hmm.
We call that in mathematics emergent behavior, where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. The sum of these are these little Legos, dumb little Legos that can be put together in certain ways, and snap your fingers and you get a car and it drives.
Hmm.
Well, that's called bottom-up processing. And human neurons do bottom-up processing. That's what where your ideas come from. But human brains are hierarchical. So the human brain is like made of like Russian dolls of structures. You have very large structures like a cerebral hemisphere or a lobe like the frontal lobe, and within them you have other structures like the lateral or like the prefrontal cortex, and within that there's other structures like the lateral prefrontal cortex, and within that there's another structures, and so on till they're smaller and smaller. So on all different scales, from the bottom of the neural nets to the top, you know, let's say the lobe, cerebral lobe, at all levels there are these different structures. And so your brain can work by generating ideas on the neural net level that from the bottom that percolate up, but also you have the filters on the top that keep track of what's my goals, what do I want to do, what's my attention on right now, and they filter out these ideas. And so there's a tension between the bottom up and a human, between the bottom up and the top down thinking. Mm-hmm. The bottom up creates elastic thinking. The top down is logical, analytical thinking. And in life, we need a balance of it. I'm not saying that you need just elastic thinking, but what I'm saying is it's been underappreciated historically.
Right. And of course, this is keenly interesting to me because, you know, at Second City, we create in groups. And there's a lot of behavioral science that says that that's a very ineffective way to operate. But they're not studying us, right? You know, they're studying groups that come together for the first time. And of course, that's not going to be necessarily relevant. And I think this ties into an item that comes up over and over again in this podcast, which is this myth of the soul creative, the myth of the soul genius, which is so storied in our country. You write, quote, "Our culture tends to view discovery and innovation as materializing out of nothing, the product of the ethereal magic of a gifted intellect. But breakthrough ideas, like mundane ideas, often arise from the association and recombination of what's already lying around in the corners of our minds." And I think that also is about connection, right, and how we connect with other human beings to make discoveries.
Definitely. Very few people, perhaps nobody, not even Einstein or Newton, worked alone. Newton, who is historically one of the great introverts and loners, communicated with a lot of people by mail. Mm-hmm. And was dependent on their ideas and their input and their reactions. In fact, his biggest discovery, his laws of motion, came as a result of an interaction he had with someone who visited him, and they were having a conversation, and Newton went away with this idea, and then 3 years later, I think it was, it came up. But Einstein had, you know, Bessel that he worked with. He had, you know, he wouldn't have done what he did without his friend who helped him with the math and who they traded ideas with. And we don't, the history books don't tend to talk about that, but we all need these interactions. And not just that, but for real elastic thinking, we need to open ourselves to other ideas. So we need almost by definition to have interactions, because mm-hmm. you have your own realm, however you grew up and whatever experiences you've had and however your brain is built, you have your own realm. You have your own social realm too, and that's all very limiting, because you have what you have. Now, if you want to go beyond that, if you want to broaden your thinking, if you want to have new ideas and new ways of looking at things, research has shown that that is greatly enhanced by having new experiences, by talking to people of the type that you would not normally meet, yeah. Of different cultures, listening to different ideas. There's been very amazing experiments where people are exposed to really crazy, ludicrous, even silly ideas, and afterwards they're tested and they find that they do better in problem solving. They have a broader range of ideas just after being exposed to an idea that's very different, even if it's absurd. So even the ideas that you dismiss as being stupid have a good effect on you. So it's good to interact with other people and other ideas.
Kind of fiercely relevant.
Just toss in we're talking so much about art. Let me just connect this to the economic world today. I mean, why do you need to be able to be open to these crazy ideas? Just look at, let's say, Encyclopedia Britannica, okay, a revered company that had been around, I don't know, 100 years, right? Wikipedia comes along with crazy ideas. They say we don't need experts to write articles. That, you know, let everybody write the article, make it open, and the law of large numbers or the wisdom of the crowd will make it work, right? They say, I'm not even talking about putting it online. That's the that's the just the smallest of the ideas, right? But that was one assumption. Encyclopedia Britannica not only didn't get that idea, they couldn't accept it. They weren't open to considering it, right? They could have scooped Wikipedia by copying them using their database of existing articles, opening it up and becoming a supercharged Wikipedia from day one, right?
Mm-hmm.
They also were stuck with this idea that they have to sell it instead of, you know, asking for donations online. Cab companies that apply elastic thinking to become more efficient now are being killed by a new way of thinking, Uber, Lyft, you know, a new. So everywhere you look, Kodak couldn't get in with the digital photos. Wherever you look, there are companies that, not just artists and writers and comedians, but there are business people and companies that, by failing to open themselves up to new and different ideas, have just been trounced and left in bankruptcy. And in our own lives, in our own companies where we're working, the competition is getting to be like that, too. People are becoming more open and more creative, and what we're doing is being challenged by new technologies from the outside, companies that VCs are supporting to come in and change the way we do things. And if we don't react and adapt, none of us will thrive.
I don't know if you've seen any of this research. There's been a few studies around joke processing in fMRI studies, mm-hmm. where they're connecting the having an insight with the way that we also experience processing a joke.
I remember those studies. And, you know, the interesting thing about jokes, I don't know if you saw this study, but to me the most interesting studies were the ones that connected jokes and metaphors and brain damage.
Yes.
How's that for it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. It makes sense from my business.
Well, what they noticed was that people with certain kinds of right hemisphere brain damage had some language deficits that they couldn't understand metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
But they also had humor deficits. They couldn't understand jokes, and these scientists were wondering, what's the connection? And they realized that language processing is a kind of problem solving.
Right.
And when you hear a sentence, all the words of the sentence have multiple meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know, if you look up any word in a dictionary, you will find multiple meanings, and you don't know when someone strings them together in a sentence which meaning it is. Mm-hmm. You have to hear the sentence first. So your brain and your working memory, the psychologists call it, which is like your RAM, you're holding all these words together, and then as more and more words of the sentence come out, and you're taking also to account the context of the whole discussion, your brain figures out which meaning to assign to each word and makes the sentence meaningful. Now, a metaphor is a case where that's an obscure meaning for the word. Like if you say, you're the light of my life. Well, light has different meanings, but none of the literal meanings has to do with electromagnetic radiation, right?
Nope.
Light in this case is an emotional inspiration meaning, and that's what they would call a remote or obscure meaning for that word. And the people who had this kind of brain damage were unable to get those ideas, those remote, those unusual ideas, only conventional ideas would come to them, very literal, okay? So the point is that these nuances or different possibilities of words is what gives a joke its humor, and it's the same thing of giving a metaphor its meaning, and that's why the people with the brain damage had this deficit in both.
Yeah. We have a program called Brand Stage that we do at Second City where we work with corporations and brands with our partners at Kantar and their insights people, but we actually put brands through a Second City process. So, you know, we invite in the audiences. So instead of a focus group, they're an audience. We lower the lights, you know, we put the brand on stage in the hand of improvisers and we play with it. All to do with what you're talking about. Cause what we're trying to do is, we're trying to mine for unexpected insights. Cause, you know, the edges is where all the good stuff comes from. In my time at Second City, it's like, you know, the scenes that were so on the nose that, you know, that you saw were predictable. They never stay in the show. It's always the surprising stuff that is so delightful for audiences. But, you know, in corporate America and even in creative shops and advertising companies, marketing companies, they're still sort of caught in their patterns. And you even talk about the fact that, you know, introducing a little discord, changing your surroundings, all of those things can contribute to better elastic thinking.
Right, because those are the things that encourage your mind to broaden its perspective. And I love what you're doing with the brands, because many companies don't see it that way. They're very conventional in their thinking, and they see their corporation as being top-down driven.
Yeah.
So the CEO knows what the brand is and knows what he or she wants to have happen and just orders people to do things, and nobody's open to new insights or ideas coming up. And they wouldn't admit that, but that's the way it works. I have a friend, and her boss told her at one point, it's my job to give you ideas, and it's your job to execute them.
Yeah.
That's all I want. So they're not looking for ideas coming from the employees or new ways of looking at things or new angles for their product. They think they know it all already, and then they end up, of course, like Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right. Okay, so we're coming close to the end, and I am going to ask you for a yes-and story. But before we do that, I do want to talk to you about Stephen Hawking, and I know we lost him recently, and I'm very sorry for that. You talk about talking with Stephen Hawking and that this slower pace of conversation, quite slow, right? Really, I think, and I didn't quote you here, but you talked about a depth of thought and communication that existed when you were forced to just slow yourself down. So I wanted to kind of unpack that with you a little bit.
Sure. Well, I worked with him for probably a period of about 8 years, and we worked very closely. I mean, he lived in Cambridge, England, and I was at Caltech.
Mm-hmm.
He came every year for about a month, and I would go to Cambridge quite often. And when we worked together, I would literally sit elbow to elbow with him, and he's in his wheelchair composing his thoughts. And I would speak, and he would compose his thoughts. And the way he communicated was quite tedious. At first, when I first started working with him, he could still move his thumb, and later they set up something that depended on him moving his cheek,
mm-hmm.
the motion detector on his glasses. And what those movements would do would be translated to the click of a mouse. And on his screen, there would be letters and words for him to choose by doing this click. And so the cursor would move around. He'd click to capture something, and that's how he composed it. And the details don't really matter, but he was able to communicate at about 6 words a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So just think about that. He was able to communicate at about 6 words. A minute is about 12 words. So that's 2 minutes and what I said in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And so the talking to him at first for me was very tedious. My mind would wander. Maybe I would surf the web while I'm waiting. Of course, you could always look over his... I was sitting right next to him, look over his shoulder and see what was starting to come out and guess what he was going to say. And if you were fairly accurate, he didn't mind you interrupting and say, oh, you're saying this? You know,
mm-hmm.
If you weren't, let me tell you, he wasn't too happy. So, you know, you got to know him more, you would get a little better, or you would just shut up and wait. But and he could answer certain things with his face. He could frown for no and smile for yes. And so that's how you would converse.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that after a while, I learned that, especially as we got into deep discussions and I'm waiting, that I would start thinking about what we were talking about. And I would think much more deeply than I would in a normal conversation, because in a normal conversation, you speak, then I speak. You speak and wait 5 minutes, and then I speak.
Yeah.
Right? So in those five seconds, I can't come up perhaps with the best or deepest reply. But if I have 5 minutes, I can do much better. And with Stephen, that became my mode of working with him, that I would no longer surf the web or daydream while I'm waiting for him, or even necessarily try to shortcut things by guessing what he's going to say. What I would do is I would see what's starting to come out, and I would start thinking about what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I would debate it within myself, and I would think, you know, much more deeply about it. And I found that was a very interesting way of communicating, and led to different answers altogether than in a normal conversation.
That's really lovely. I mean, it is. I mean, you're forced. This is the thing about, and people always misunderstand often what improvisation is and think it's completely free form. I'm like, there are so many constraints, and the constraints are awesome. You know, and improvisation, especially when you tighten up some of these constraints and you force people to maneuver into tight spaces, right? You really get a lot of powerful, deep thinking. And this idea of, I mean, we could all I think, benefit from slowing down. You had to really slow down. So that's and look, it taught you something. So I think that states the case. So we ask every guest who comes on the podcast for a yes and story. And the idea here in improvisation is when you're making something out of nothing with groups of people, saying no gets you nowhere. You got to say yes and. And I wonder if you have a story for us.
I've got a million stories from the Yes And City. Well, one that affected my life quite a bit was I was a graduate student at Berkeley, physics, theoretical physics, and I was working on a problem which was had to do with how atoms behave outside of neutron stars, where there's a very, very intense magnetic field, and nobody knew at that time how to solve the equations to explain how the atoms behave. And I had a friend, a postdoc, a Greek guy who just come from Princeton, and he was working on something completely different. He was working on in a field called quantum field theory, which I actually was fond of and had studied quite a bit. And he was working on a completely different problem in his area. And we were talking one day, and he said, "You know, this what I've got is really interesting stuff, and maybe you'd like to work together." Because I was telling him that I was kind of lonely; my advisor was ignoring me. He wasn't that interested in what I was doing. I had to completely work on my own, and I had no one to talk to. And he said, "Well, why don't you work with me?" And I'm thinking, "No, I've got this problem. You've got your problem, and it's like this is not my, you know, that's not my my thesis problem." And but then instead of doing that, I said, yes, and, well, yeah, let's work together, because I see, let me see if there's some aspect, I had a hunch that something with what he was doing could be applicable to what I was doing, even though they were apples and oranges, so yeah. They were completely different things. And it led to an amazing discovery, and it got me my faculty job at Caltech, and blah, blah, blah. It was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it only came because I didn't dismiss it right away, the conventional, or let's say scripted, automatic, autopilot kind of response where, I have this problem to solve, you have that problem to solve, but rather I looked to see if there could be some crazy way of, you know, mixing the apples and the oranges or the Greek and Latin roots to form a crazy hybrid word, you know. So
that's great. Leonard Mlodinow, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, working in a coal mine.